Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Mike and Hannah. I am Mike, and with me, as always, is Hannah. How are you this Saturday evening, Hannah?
Very well, thank you. Ready for season two.
Looking forward to season two of Twin Peaks. We're going to be covering the feature length, so it's going to be a late one for us. It's a feature length episode, so we're saving this for
Saturday.
I have
a feeling this is going to happen over two nights.
No.
Yeah, we'll see.
My God, Hannah, what kind of negative attitude is that? Well, I'll tell you what, then, in the spirit of that, we'll make short work of the pre...
I do have some feedback.
Okay. Well, tell us, what are we talking about tonight, Hannah?
We are talking about an episode called May the Giant Be With You.
Okay. Unofficially.
Everybody knows that at this point.
This could be the first episode that somebody's listening to, and they're like, well, actually, you know, pushing their glasses up their nose.
Well, they can just actually away somewhere else.
Okay.
Okay, plot synopsis says, a wounded Agent Cooper has a vision of a giant who gives him several clues about the murder of Laura Palmer. Shelley and Pete recover from the mill fire, but Josie and Catherine are missing. It is directed by David Lynch and written by... Mark Frost and David Lynch.
Cool. So it's the first episode directed by Lynch and written by Lynch and Frost since the third episode. So that should be interesting. Yes, so this is the first episode of season two, much longer season. Mm-hmm. 22 episodes in this season versus the eight, if you count the pilot from the first. So, yeah, looking forward to getting into this one. A couple of quick bits of housekeeping before we get into things. A reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. And also, you can leave comments on our YouTube channel, which we will read out as feedback if it feels appropriate to do so. And also, you can give us hopefully positive reviews at Spot On, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
I thought you were going to say it's Spot On Fire.
Spot On Fire, I think you'll think it's called. And also... on Apple Podcasts, and we are available to converse with on Instagram and Twitter, where in both instances we are at Rewatch Pod. Check out our friend shows too, including Chin Stroker versus Punter, his film Her Movie, Film Bastards, well, he said the Iron Sequel, but that hasn't been part of the family
good,
for
the
a
bad,
really
and
long
the
time.
Odd.
The Good, the Bad, and the Odd, Talk Without Rhythm podcast, and Video Game Landfill. So check all of those out. Do we have any feedback, Anna?
We do.
All right, hit us.
Okay, so first I have an email entitled Peaks. Really glad to hear you were covering Fire Walk With Me and Twin Peaks. I was wondering, do you have a favourite piece of music in Twin Peaks? Mm. Also, are there any other TV shows that you think have great scores? I generally find TV scores to be pretty plain compared to more lush movie scores. Curious to hear your thoughts. Loving the podcast and can't wait to hear your thoughts on season two. Alex in LA. Thanks, Alex.
After you.
Favourite piece of music in Twin Peaks. There is a jukebox song that I think it was in the pilot. I think I mentioned
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. That Bobby puts on when he's leaving with Shelley.
Yeah, I particularly love that song.
Yeah, it's called I'm Hurt Bad. It's an instrumental piece by Angela Bedelamati.
I very much enjoy that. Yeah, I think that's probably my favourite. Mm-hmm. What about you?
I could talk for an hour about the music in Twin Peaks.
Talk for a few minutes.
I mean, I wore out my CDs of the original TV music. I wore out my CD of Floating Into the Night, the album that Judy Cruz did with, one of two albums that Judy Cruz did with David Lynch and Angela Bedelamati. And I also wore out my CD copy of the Fire Walk With Me soundtrack as well. So there's a lot of great pieces of music on there.
It's very much in your wheelhouse.
Yeah. I love that kind of... in Twin Peaks, there's several different types of music. You've got the kind of the sort of quirky, almost bebop-y jazz stuff. Mm. You've got the sort of synthy score, like just the straightforward score. And then you've got the kind of dream pop. The kind of Cocteau Twins-y, This Mortal Coil-ish stuff that Judy Cruz does. But I've got a lot. I mean, probably my favourite piece of music in all of Twin Peaks is Rocking Back Inside My Heart by Judy Cruz, which is in I think the 8th episode of season 2, but and there's some really amazing pieces of music on the Firewalk Me soundtrack. There's a song called A Real Indication by Angelo Badalamonte. It's actually got a vocal by Angelo Badalamonte that's crazy. There's a really great song called The Sycamore Trees by Jimmy Scott that's on the final episode of season 2. But I think for me, in some ways, the key piece of music is the Laura Palmer theme.
Yeah.
Because there's two halves to it. There's the synthy ominous bit, and then there's the kind of melodramatic weepy piano section. And to me, that's Twin Peaks. You know, you've got those, the darkness and the weirdness, and then you've got
it's the kind of a character of its own as music.
It's like you've got, there's a great YouTube clip of, and I think from one of the bonus features on Twin Peaks, of Badalamonte talking about that. But I mean, the other thing, of course, is that Badalamonte and Lynch have collaborated on most of David Lynch's films.
Yeah.
So I feel like the music of Twin Peaks is part of a larger body of work. I mean,
100%.
You know, there's The Mysteries of Love by Julie Cruise from the Blue Velvet soundtrack's an amazing song as well.
Mm.
And there's some great stuff on the Lost Highway soundtrack. But yeah, if I had to pick any piece of music.
In terms of David Lynch, I really like it when he goes more sort of 50s pop.
Yeah.
That is my absolute weakness in life.
Yeah.
I love in Mulholland Drive when she sings Every Little Star.
Yeah.
I really love the, what's that instrumental? Is it called Sleepwalk?
Yeah.
Like, I love that. That to me is dreamy music.
Well, it's funny. There's a Stephen King film called Sleepwalkers starring Mae Chynamic from the early 90s. Mm. And that song is all the way through the film.
Yeah.
And that was one of the many films that, a bit like after Pulp Fiction, everybody was trying to be like Tarantino. There was a couple of years when there were a lot of kind of doo-woppy 50s diner kind of aesthetic movies that were obviously coming from Twin Peaks. I always associate that. But funnily enough, that piece of music is in season 3 of Twin Peaks after being used in loads of things to kind of elicit a David Lynchy vibe. David Lynch himself actually finally got around to using that piece of music.
Yeah. Other TV shows, I can think of a couple.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, who's this email from again?
Alex in
Alex.
LA.
Alex from LA. I mean, he's right, or she, actually. I probably shouldn't assume gender there, but oh, they, hell. TV isn't great for music. There's a lot of great themes, like TV themes, but actual score, I don't know.
That came to mind almost immediately when reading this was Rings of Power.
That's got a great score, isn't it?
The music in that TV series is fantastic.
It's really symphonic, isn't it?
Rings of Power, which is basically the prequel to Lord of the Rings, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I loved it. And it was so funny as well. I was talking to Ian in Birmingham about that. And he was like, there are people who don't like that, aren't there? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I do not understand that. I think another great
score. It was such compelling TV. Like, it got to the point where it was like, oh, I've got to watch the next one.
I should point out as well, we've got a new TV. And I'm really looking forward to season 2 of Rings of Power on that.
When is that due out?
I don't know. They've shot it.
The other TV show I think has good use of music is Better Call Saul.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
very much so.
I think now you more and more you see either songs being appropriated into TV shows, which didn't used to happen that much, or it's just wallpaper. Music's just wallpaper. Yeah. I think season 1 of The Mandalorian. Some of the stuff that Ludwig Göransson did for that was like really legitimately good. Innovative music in its own right, like using weird old organic instruments. I thought that was a great one. But
I tell you what though, there is a hell of a lot to be said for things like Magnum PI, Hill Street Blues,
Cagney and Lacey, great memorable catchy Airwolf, pieces of music,
just fucking.
MacGyver. One of the things, they had to capture your attention so quickly. They're almost like jingles. Yeah. You know, they've got as much in common with jingles. And you know, those great TV themes of the 70s and 80s, or, you know.
But they, like a lot of those 70s and 80s shows, would use their theme music in ways throughout the show.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't just theme music, then nothing.
Yeah, they'd have character themes and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't really get that now.
No.
Well,
you don't get opening credit sequences. You get a title and a sound.
Yeah.
You know, Lost ushered that era in. What else you got, Hannah?
Oh, right. Sorry.
Go on. Did you not episode tonight, and I want to talk about it tonight.
My,
I'm not into this. I'm not into this tapping out early business.
Okay, we've got a voicemail from Mark.
Oh, a voicemail. Excellent. Exciting.
Just got to download it. Here we go.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Hannah. It is I, Mark. Yeah. So you finished season one, or finished rewatching season one. Brilliant season. Remains brilliant. Doesn't matter how many times you watch it. I've watched, I think I'm on my ninth rewatch now. So, yeah, remains brilliant. Looking forward to starting season two. And I'm a big fan of season two all the way through. Unlike some people, I like season two all the way through. Yeah, I thought the last episode I listened to, which was about the finale of season one, was really interesting. Mike made some interesting points. I didn't realise how Mark Frosty it was until Mike pointed it out. So I found the actual recorded, you know, your show really useful and insightful, and made me think again about that final episode. Really interesting. Yes, the Mark Frostiness is all part of the mix, and it often gets forgotten behind the David Lynch, but it's as important, as is quite a lot of supporting materials that have come out recently. Or I'll say recently, when season three came out. Yeah, there was some really cool stuff that came out that sort of supported and augmented stuff about Twin Peaks then that I think mostly came from Mark Frost, though obviously David Lynch was the main driver in season three. So I'm looking forward to you starting season two. In terms of my rewatch journeys, there's a few things I wanted to note to you, but just a few things. First, I'm watching Deep Space Nine. I finished season two. Still not thoroughly absorbed at all. Problem I'm having is most of the Starfleet characters I just don't find interesting. I don't really like Sisko much. Dax is bland.
He doesn't kick off until season three, like we've been telling you since the beginning.
I can't remember his name, it's curious. Not interested. I like Odo. I like Quark. I like O'Brien. O'Brien's the one Starfleet guy I really like. Wolf's not in it yet, so that's, not neither here nor there. And I really like the new one, and Andy Robinson's Cardassian character. Is it Gallim? I really like him. He's really growing on me, and I think he is one to watch. He really lights up the screen. And there's a few occasional characters I quite like too, or I find it interesting. They add something to it. But nah, Deep Space Nine is not grabbing me still. I've just finished season six of Buffy. Absolutely fantastic season. Really, really good. Really deep things going on. It's about grief and mourning and loss, isn't it? I mean, it really is. It's such a great season. I've really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to seeing the final season soon. But yeah, this is the first watch for me, I'll remind you. So yeah, this was all new to me. I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was terrific. You know what? I think Spike is possibly the most interesting character of all. Yes. And some of the stuff that goes down with Spike and Buffy in this season is funny, but also super dark in some places. So I was shocked how dark it went, actually, and how dark the season finished, really, as well. Really good. Really enjoyed it. Last thing I want to mention, Doctor Who. Still working with Doctor Who. Just finished. I'm now on the seventh Doctor iteration, and I've just finished the Sylvester McCoy start of season 25, which is Remembrance of the Daleks. Absolute banger. Sylvester McCoy absolutely knocks it out of the park. In fact, the whole production knocks it out of the park. It's a really, really classic episode. I have seen it before, but I just forgotten how much I enjoyed it till I rewatched this one. So, yeah. So, will you guys ever cover Doctor Who, do you think? That's a hell of a rewatch, right? I mean, I'm in it myself, so, you know, I know. I've been on it 3 years, by the way, I think. I watch one story a week, and it's been nearly 3 years of watching so far, and I haven't even started the new era yet. So, you know, I've got a lot ahead of me as well as a lot behind me. Anyway, enough of that. I am so glad you guys are enjoying X-Files. Such a great show. And I'm glad Hannah has totally ignored Mike about, the fifth word, stop at the fifth. Nonsense. What a lot of nonsense. One final thing. James isn't cool. Okay. Bye from me.
James is cool.
Thank you, Mark. Fantastic voicemail as usual.
Thank you, buddy. Always great to hear from you.
Yeah.
It would have been weird if we hadn't.
Season 6 of Buffy, fully on board with everything you said. I think it's probably my favourite season as well.
I'm jealous of anybody who hasn't seen Buffy, who gets to binge it.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a treat.
And season 6 is such a bingeable season of it.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine.
Stick with it.
Yeah, you haven't even got to the entree yet of amazing it is.
I mean, just think about the next gen. You know, I mean, season 1 and 2 of Deep Space Nine are better than season 1 of The Next Generation. And The Next Generation is considered one of the greatest TV shows of all time.
You've still got so much good shit to come.
Yeah, I mean, without getting into the weeds, the Deep Space Nine was very much living in the shadow of The Next Generation. Because The Next Gen was still on for the first 2 seasons of Deep Space Nine. So there was a lot of pressure on Deep Space Nine to basically be the next gen, but on a space station.
Mm.
When the next gen goes off the air, Voyager comes out, and you know, as the writers of the show said, the Eye of Sauron goes onto Voyager, and at that point, Paramount loses all interest in Deep Space Nine, lets them do what they want, and it becomes a great show. I like Deep Space Nine from the beginning, you know. So I
probably got into it. You know, more than Mark has currently.
Yeah.
But I would have to say that the best is definitely yet to come.
Also, you were so immersed in Star Trek at that point because we watched Next Gen and went straight into it. We were like watching at least one episode of Next Gen every day.
At least one.
And we went straight into Deep Space Nine. So you were just in that frame. You were in that headspace.
I wasn't able to watch anything but that. Yeah. I was having a bit of a mental health breakdown
Star Trek,
in
weirdly.
Real life.
I mean, particularly 90s Star Trek, it's a tricky show to just sit down and watch one episode of because you've got to kind of get in the zone, not story-wise, but 90s Star Trek has such a particular vibe.
It does,
that
yeah.
It kind of needs to be all you're watching for you to really get into it in some ways.
And perhaps that's why I got into DS9 so quickly.
Yeah.
Because we were just like full on.
We primed the pump.
Yeah. But I mean, it did take me quite a while to transition from Next Gen to DS9. You know, my loyalty was very much in the Next Gen vibe.
Yeah.
So to kind of recognise all the goodness in DS9 did take a while for me.
Yeah.
But, man, DS9 is why I watched Babylon 5.
Yeah.
So let that just ruminate with you.
Yeah, I think that pound for pound, I still think Deep Space Nine is the most satisfying Star Trek. I mean, the thing about Deep Space Nine that's unique is it's a complete story.
Hmm.
There's no movies, there's no other bits, there's no spin-offs. It's just, it's like a book. It's like a big book.
Yeah.
You know, and Doctor Who, Hannah, you've watched any Doctor Who?
Yeah, I've watched lots of Doctor Who. It was a, you know, absolute staple in the house when I was a kid. Used to be on at 5 o'clock. So I very much associate it with that time of day.
I've drifted in and out over the years.
I mean, I used to watch it every day as a kid, and then, you know, just had a very big break from it. Purely, like, I used to do competitive dancing, and I really didn't watch a lot of TV. I just didn't have time. Then got back into it with Christopher Eccleston and watched it pretty consistently with him and David Tennant, then fell away at Matt Smith. And
you see,
have
Matt
been
Smith
in
is probably
and
my favourite of the newer ones.
I haven't really watched a lot
I
of
think
his.
You would really like the Matt Smith role of Doctor Who, because it's got almost a kind of Harry Potterish vibe. It's very kind of fairy tale-y almost.
Yeah, I've watched the odd episode and enjoyed it, but I've never like solidly watched a season.
I've not seen all. I'd like to watch the Matt Smith run again, like, well, or watch it properly.
I think in terms of a rewatch project, we won't be doing that.
Well, no,
it's just way too much. But it could be like something for like a sorbet,
like a classic run or something.
Pick a couple of like really amazing classic episodes.
Yeah.
Would be kind of a cool thing. I remember watching the first one when Daleks fly. The Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They got the stairs.
And going like, oh, good. Nobody's safe. Yeah. That was pretty cool. Yeah.
All right, let's punch it. We're going to hit pause. We're going to watch the first episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks, and then we'll come back and tell you what we thought.
See you later.
Swear you'll listen to the good, the bad, and the odd. The good. He has the cruelty of Jack Nicholson's Joker, the wit of Mark Hamill's Joker, and the laugh of Cesar Romero. The bad.
He's bald, he's got a cat, he lives in a volcano. What else you need?
And the odd.
I've seen bits of it, it's really stupid.
Swear to me.
Just a couple of guys talking about movies. You can find us on www.thegoodthebadandtheodd.com. The good, the bad, and the odd.com.
What a beautiful podcast.
And we're back. So we've just finished watching the first episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks. Hannah, initial thoughts?
Like a fantastic start to the second season, terrifying at the end, made me jump a couple of times. Exactly what you would hope for in the beginning of a fantastic next season. What about you?
There's a lot in this episode. The thing that really always jumps out to me about this is that it feels like it's a sort of thickening of the tone, style, and mythology of the show.
Mm.
Like, it really just feels like they're really kind of crystallizing it and not trying to... Not pander, because I don't think the first season was pandering, but it definitely feels like there's an element of, if you don't like this, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to be watching this show anymore. But it just feels like there's a sort of solidification of what the show is.
Yeah.
And a focus.
Yeah.
To this, which is a weird thing to say about like a 90-minute episode.
No, but it doesn't feel like 90 minutes. I mean, it didn't... feel like
a movie-length
episode to me. I thought it goes quite quickly. It was great.
The other thing about this episode that I always think about is, do you remember when I think we were seeing each other at this point. I went to see Twin Peaks at the Battersea Arts Centre.
No.
Was that before?
Yeah, no, that was before me.
And this was they showed the whole show. It was like a 30-hour thing. And it started at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning and then ran all day and overnight. And they had a break between the season finale of season 1 and the beginning of season 2. And I feel like it kind of peaked with this episode, because this episode was after the break and was about 9 o'clock on like the Saturday night.
Yeah.
And I went into it thinking, shit, well, this is like 30 hours. How do you like pace yourself for that? And it was awesome what they did at the Battersea Arts Centre, because they had the whole building and they'd done it out and they had like Twin Peaks themed rooms and people were cosplaying and there was like art installations and music stuff. But when they had the break between the seasons, of course, that's when everybody hit the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like music playing and all that kind of stuff. So that was the point where you had to decide your path. Mm-hmm. You're like, do I embrace the fact that it's Saturday night and it's kind of a Twin Peaks party, but that will cost me?
Yeah.
Or do I just abstain and go for the whole one? Well, I mean, You know me.
Yeah. I was going to say, you were definitely not option two.
So for the whole of the first season, it was all very studious. But then when everybody came back for this
second season, it was party time.
Well, everybody had a bit of a buzz on.
Mm.
And it was kind of the perfect episode for that because you've got loads of great, there's some great music in this episode.
Mm.
There's some great kind of hard Lynchian darkness.
Mm.
There's some like great Albert.
Mm.
There's some really funny stuff. There's a lot of really kind of like, if you think of the mythology of Twin Peaks, this is a really important episode. So much stuff comes out of this. That it was the perfect episode. And I remember I did great after this, but the point where I, and a lot of people, of course, checked out, spoiler alert, was the James and Evelyn. That was the point about 10 episodes into the second season where you were either going to leave or you were going to make it to the end.
Yeah.
And that was my thinking, was because I was there with my friend Barney, and we finished the final episode of the first season. We went to the bar, and I remember realizing I was in the right place because there was a girl singer with a group. You would have loved this. It was like proper, they were singing like doo-woppy kind of songs. Yeah. And as we walked in the bar, they were playing Just You and I, you know, the song that James Hurley sings in season two. And it was like 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, had a couple of drinks, and I was just thinking, I'm in the right place. And at that point, I thought, I can either have a great time now and for like the next 3 or 4 episodes of Twin Peaks, or abstain completely and just power through to the end. And then I thought, I know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, you were never going to do the second one. It's like when we went to the Edgar Wright, you know, like 24
hours. Oh, we all fell asleep on that.
Yeah. But I mean,
I don't think we were even drinking, were we?
Yeah.
Were we?
Yes, we were drinking. Yes.
We're going to Burger King.
Yeah. We did have a few drinks, but it was just, we were in a movie theatre.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah.
It's like the worst night's sleep I've ever had.
But the reason I mention it is that's what I always think about when I think about this episode is that. And I also like, let's get into it. Let's get into the breakdown. So we get a longer version of the opening credits. And it's weird. They only do this twice in the whole show. They do it on the pilot and this episode. So it's like the only two feature-length episodes. Because you know how, like, I mean, we've talked about this before, about how American TV shows do that thing where you've got, like, the opening credits, where you've got, like, a bunch of names, and then it'll finish. And then over the first couple of scenes, you'll then have that episode's credits, so the people who worked on just that episode.
Mm.
But what this episode does is it has a much longer version of the theme with lots of imagery that we don't normally see, but has all of the credits over that.
Yeah.
I've got no idea why, but it's one of those odd things that I kind of, like, you know, can't help but notice.
Is it anything to do with the In Loving Memory of whoever it was?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't even know who that was, but it might have been. But I think part of it might just be that it was a longer episode, so they just paced it differently. You know, they were like, we can take a little bit more time about this kind of stuff.
Mm.
So we open up with the bellhop walking in and onto the wounded Cooper. And he's played by a guy called Hank Warden. And
I know he's the first thing you see, and of course you will remember him from this episode, but the thing that I remember a lot from this episode in particular is his thumbs up and winking, because he winks like our children do, like very...
With his whole face.
Yeah, just like really deliberate winking.
Yeah.
Say that without trying
to... I know where your mind's going.
Yeah.
But that guy, Hank Warden, he must have been really old when they did this, because he was like, he played the old guy, like the token old guy in loads of John Wayne westerns.
Mm.
That was his thing. He was a western actor.
Mm.
And, you know, to think that, like, even in like the early 90s, he was still playing like the token old guy. But this whole scene, the whole tone of the scene, I mean, it's interesting because, of course, we talked about in the last episode about how a lot of the audience of Twin Peaks, like the mainstream kind of water cooler audience, like revolted on the show because they didn't reveal who killed Laura Palmer. And I can only imagine how those people who did come back felt about like 15 minutes of just this slow, syrupy kind of almost like confrontationally, funereally paced scene. But I mean, I'm not bored when I'm watching that. You know, no. I'm not watching it thinking, oh God, what a great art experiment this is. Or
it wasn't like, I mean, okay, yes, it's odd. And
you're waiting to see what happened. Yeah.
And he is very bizarre in the fact that he doesn't even recognize that he needs help and, you know, whatever. But, and that is very Lynchian, but it's not art house in like, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's just a old guy bringing a warm milk.
And I often wonder about whether David Lynch actually is even interested in subverting expectation. You know, I mean, you've got, you know, obviously the first season ended with multiple cliffhangers. And the whole point of cliffhangers is to draw the audience back, you know, to make them just be chomping at the bit to find out what happens. So to start with just this, you know, performative, slow sequence, you know, does feel a little bit like trying to separate the wheat from the chaff as far as the audience goes, you know. And I can almost imagine, you know, the ABC, you know, television network just watching like the lights blink out of the audience, you know, and seeing them, the viewing figures drop. And, you know, I think that a few of the audience came back a little bit later to see who killed Laura Palmer. But it does feel like almost an aggressive attempt to alienate certain parts of the audience.
Well, it's just, you know, you're separating the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah.
You want people who are like really invested in it. You don't want tourists.
Yeah.
At this point, you want people. You want locals.
Yeah, and also I suppose, you know, like all these TV shows, there'd been a gap, so they'd had an opportunity to. I mean, the show had become a cultural phenomenon. I mean, they shot all of season one pretty much in one go. So this is the first episode that they shot knowing that this show was a big deal. So that must have kind of like factored into it a little bit. But I think also part of it is I think David Lynch and Mark Frost just made the episode of television that they wanted to make.
Yeah.
I think that maybe they had a little bit more latitude because of the success of the show.
Yeah.
So they kind of felt confident enough to push it a little bit more.
Like he said in the interview you did with him, the cliffhangers was absolutely a way of ensuring, you know, that they got picked up again.
Oh, did he say that?
Yeah, I listened to it again.
Okay, I have not heard that in like 10 years, so I can't remember.
Yeah, no, he said that, you know, putting all the cliffhangers in was a way for him to kind of, to basically ensure that the show would be picked up for another series. Oh, so there's like a tactical element to doing. Yeah, yeah. But then he also goes on to say he did that at the end of season two and it didn't work.
Yeah. So, well, yeah.
So,
well, it did. It just took 30 years.
Yeah.
we did get to find out what happened and he got to come back, you know.
Yeah.
But, oh, that's interesting. I'd completely forgotten about that. So we see the giants appear. Lurch from the Addams Family, of course. And he tells Cooper three things. And
I love him. He's so calm.
He is a very calming presence, isn't he? And, I mean, the other element here as well is that arguably this is a escalation of the, for want of a better word, supernatural elements of the show. I mean, this is probably kind the of stuff with the giants in this episode is probably the most explicitly supernatural element so far in the show, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like he He gives Cooper...
Yeah, because the Red Room, that was a dream, it was wasn't a dream. It? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was presented.
Presented as a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas here, I mean, the moment where Cooper, later in the episode, realizes that he doesn't have his ring anymore is kind of the show telling us to that take happened. This. It's real. Yeah. This is real.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
You know, it gives him several clues. Kind of similar, I guess, to what happened with the little man from another place. This idea that there's these cryptic
Sometimes my arm's been back.
Yes, yeah. It's exactly the same as that. So you can't help but wonder as an audience member that maybe they come from the same place.
Yeah. So there's the man in the smiling bag.
Yeah.
What was the second one?
There's... Leo is in a hungry horse.
Yeah.
The owls are not what they seem.
Yeah, the owls are not what they seem. And something about a chemical.
Oh, without chemicals, he points.
Yeah.
Yeah, which we haven't learnt what that means yet.
Yeah. So I can't even remember what that does mean.
No. And we also get to see a kind of Lynchian stylistic thing here that I think it was maybe in Eraserhead, but I think Twin Peaks really introduced it, and you'll see it a lot in later Lynch works, is where the lighting in a scene will change.
Mm.
There'll be regular lighting, and then suddenly somebody will just be in a spotlight, and you'll get this kind of sound in the audio that implies that, like, there's heat or some kind of, like, physical intensity.
I mean, Peter Jackson did that with Gandalf as well. Like, when... he needed to be taken very seriously, that his power was larger than you gave him credit for. Everything went black around him.
Yeah. It's like stagecraft. It's revealing the kind of the artifice of stagecraft in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
He gives him these clues. We get a bit of business with Ben and Audrey, and we see Jerry and Blackie. And it's interesting as well that when you see Lynch direct an episode, you see his versions of the characters, and Jerry is a much darker character in the Lynch directed episodes. Have you noticed? There's a kind of, because he's just a silly character in a lot of the other episodes, but there's a kind of cruelty to him that you don't see in other.
I think the difference that you see in that is that in that scene with Blackie, he's not talking to someone he feels is an equal. He's talking to someone who works for him or is a subordinate.
Oh, so you see his true face.
Yeah, whereas when you see him with Ben or, you know, the people he's trying to entertain. He's
performing.
Yeah. He either admires them or is trying to impress them. So that's really the first chance you've had to see who he is, actually is.
Yeah, and he's sort of
I don't think that's a Lynch versus Frost thing. I think that is really just this is my actual character.
It's like a circumstantial almost thing, isn't it? And it's funny because you also get the reality of it as well. Like, and that's kind of what Twin Peaks is about. You know, whether it's it all goes back to Marilyn Monroe at the end of the day, this idea of iconographic imagery and then actually thinking about what that means.
Mm.
So, you know, in the case of Laura Palmer, you've got obviously the homecoming queen. And, you know, we see One-Eyed Jax in, like, you know, the fun episodes towards the end of the first season when, you know, Cooper and Ed are going undercover and bantering with Blackie and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then in this episode, we see the reality, which is that she's been forced to do this and controlled by her heroin addiction.
Yeah.
And they're supporting it. So it's kind of, it's the, it's underbelly. It's about the underbelly, you know. You enjoy it, but then...
It's the worms in the grass.
Yeah. You stop and you think about it. And we get a Diane update from Cooper as he's lying on his back. And I love this sequence. I bought a cassette audio book of Twin Peaks that came out whilst the show was on.
I thought you were going to say you bought a voice-activated dictaphone.
No, I had a voice-activated dictaphone, but not because of Twin Peaks. I had it at university to record lectures I couldn't be bothered to go to. This is before Zoom. It's what we did back then. But I
how did you record them if you weren't there?
Sorry?
How did you record them if
I got people there? To take them for me.
Well, they're very nice people.
Well, it was actually my girlfriend.
Well, she is a very nice girlfriend.
But this cassette was, it was one of the few pieces, because I've said before about how, like, Twin Peaks was really intensely merchandised for a short period of time. So, like, in like an 8-month period, like, insane amounts of stuff came out. Like, more stuff that's ever come out for any TV show over an 8-month period. But then it stopped completely.
Mm.
And one of those things was one cassette. And it was never even released on CD. It's on YouTube. You can, like, listen to it there. And it was Cooper's tapes. And there was two versions of this. There was the book, My Life, My Tapes, which was written by Scott Frost, Mark Frost's brother, which is like a really big, kind of like depthy book. And then there was the audio book of it. But all that was the all of the Dear Diane bits from the TV show compiled.
Mm.
And they'd obviously got Carl McLachlan to go into a recording studio and record interstitial stuff to expand it out to being like long enough to warrant selling.
Right.
And that came out in the UK before season 2 came out. And I bought this. And it has all the stuff from this episode, so it's got all of that. So I was like, oh, I'm getting like a little bit of insight. Spoilers, you know, before we even had the word spoilers for all of that. So whenever I hear, whenever I watch this episode and there's that bit where he talks about the voice-activated dictaphone, I always just think about sitting in my parents' living room just thinking, God, I'm sad.
it's, you didn't think, God, I'm sad. No, I didn't. You thought, God, I'm cool.
Yeah. Well, no, retroactively I do. And but because of that, I remember all of this so well. And I know you don't like it when I quote, but there is some very memorable dialogue in this episode. Like the way he describes the thing about Cooper is he's a detective, so he's dying from bullet shot wounds, but he's kind of fascinated by it and wants to explore that and share his experience of that with somebody. And like he talks about how if you can imagine the sensation of three bowling balls dropped from a height of around 9 feet, you can begin to approximate the sensation. So he's just going into this sort of zone, and kind of his coping mechanism is just by being Cooperish about it all.
Can we just circle back and take a minute to really appreciate the phrase bullet shot wounds that you just said?
Okay, gunshot wounds, sorry.
I know.
All right, Paul. Jesus, I've married my podcasting partner, literally. And you even sounded slightly Kenneth Williams-y with that laugh then. But the way that you get
I always thought you two recorded in his bedroom, so.
Well, you know, yes, really.
It's just one step through.
But you get so much insight into Cooper's character as well, the way that, like, he talks about how when you're dying, you think about all the things that you do differently, you know. And he talks about how he'd like to treat people better, although I can't see how Cooper could treat people better because he's just such a you know, damned angel.
But he's obviously thinking of past experiences that he's had.
True, and I suppose that's insightful in a sense. Maybe there is, the halo is...
And you know, that's... It's sort of a foreshadow of lots of stuff to come.
Yeah. And also, because Cooper is recovering from an injury in this episode, he's not quite the Cooper we're used to. Like, Cooper feels different in this episode because he's weakened.
He's very measured in his physical movements, which kind of...
That's a really good way of putting it, actually.
It makes him seem like when he's in that dream sequence where he can't, like, turn his head very fast.
Yeah, or, so he's tentative.
Yeah.
And like how, like when he talks about, I would very much like to go up, climb a hill, a tall hill, not too tall, and sit in the cool air, not too cool. Like even in those scenes, he's, and he talks about he wants to make love to a beautiful woman.
It's like, it's like he's trying to circumnavigate ending up in like a hellish environment where it's really cold and
he's
really like wet, cold, wet grass.
I would like to be crystal clear about my expectations for the afterlife.
Like a genie is actually going to put him in that situation, and if he hasn't been as specific as humanly possible, he's going to end up in a really shit situation.
You see, I'd never thought about this scene that way. This is why I love podcasting, because I hadn't even considered it playing, but it does make sense. He's like hedging his bets, isn't he, in a way. But and he talks about how, like, his regrets, there were certain cases that he never cracked as well.
The Lindbergh baby.
Sorry?
The Lindbergh baby.
Yes.
Which is a really fascinating case.
Yeah, it's a true one. And
I know it's a true case.
And I'm talking to our audience who aren't as well read as you, Hannah.
Well, I think our audience probably know about it as well.
Well, maybe so.
I mean, you know, if anyone has even sniffed towards the true crime section of Netflix.
Oh, okay.
We'll probably know about stuff like that. I was about to say,
maybe some of our, like, you know, TikTok-y young'uns. Although, they're probably all over TikTokers, that shit, aren't they?
I don't think there's anyone under 30 listening to us.
We see, there probably isn't.
Prove me wrong, listeners.
One of my favourite moments in this episode is when we see Cooper come to in the hospital.
Mm.
And they're all looking around him like Wizard of Oz. And, what's her name? Kimmy Robertson's character. I can't believe I've got her.
Lucy
gives him the skinny on what's happened.
Yeah.
And he's like, how long was I out? And they're like, oh, we haven't seen this much action since, like, the Great Fire of 59 or whatever. Yeah.
How she's just like, life is not worth living. There's no reason to be happy.
No. Everything although, you think, she'd be vibing it, because it feels like Invitation to Love, doesn't it? You know, what she's doing. We see Mark Frost as the TV reporter giving the update on the news. We see a Ronette starting to stir a little bit, Ronette Pulaski. We get a scene of Maddie and Sarah. Maddie is telling Sarah Palmer about how she had a dream about a certain part of the carpet.
Mm.
And then Leland walks in resplendent with white hair, and he's singing Little Lambs Eat Ivy.
Yeah.
And, just being manic. And we see the carpet kind of like brush sort of, I can't even explain it. It's a really hard, it just sort of, it goes fucking weird.
It basically does, yeah. It gets a bit of a shadow.
It goes a
body shaped shadow on it.
Yeah. A little bit like, you've got like a fabric and you brush it the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of has that effect.
Leland's hair is another thing that's very much I associate with, like, if someone sees season 2 of Twin Peaks, I think
white hair. Yeah, it's a signifier.
Yeah.
It's like Riker's beard in Next Gen, isn't it? You know when, where you are.
He should never be clean shaven. Yeah. He has not got the face.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like knowing where you are in Friends by
how fat or thin Chandler was.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
I love the scene when Leland walks into Ben and Jerry's office.
Yeah.
And he's like, just start singing. But they just go with it. And
Well, I think they see, like, oh, hello, here is our scapegoat presented.
Mm.
You know? Just as they are talking about that conundrum, he presents them a solution to it.
But I love the way that Ben jumps on the desk and Jerry does the worm. Do you notice that as well? It's kind of like, it's not a bad move. And I love the scene where Cooper and Truman they're trying to figure out what's happened at Leo's house. And Cooper's doing his Sherlock Holmes thing about, right, the bullet came through there, this happened. And there's a great little just...
Well, Truman does that.
One of them both are, sorry, But I love the way that every time, because Truman keeps mentioning Shelley, he's like, the TV going back, he's like, Shelley. And Cooper's like, Truman, no, Harry, get your mind off Shelley. But there's something so kind of like just gleeful about his delivery of that line that I just absolutely adore. And also the whole idea that when he says that, like, Shelley's like 99 pounds soaking wet. Yeah. I've never heard that term before. But that's, you hear that all the time.
It's really common.
Yeah,
it was always common.
You show me a pre-1991 example of somebody justifying somebody's weight. My granddad
used to say that about people.
You are, sorry?
My granddad, when I was little,
What, back in 92?
Oh, my God. No, he would have said that back when I was, like, 10. 89.
Yeah, you might have read the script.
Fuck off. I don't even think my granddad had a TV that had more than two channels on it.
Yeah, true. Albert turns up, and Andy gets really upset about it. And that's where he runs outside and knocks himself out, and he's just, like, in this weird
concussed stupor. I love the fact that he doesn't fall over. Like, that. It's like his the way to maintain being a man around other men is to not fall over.
But he also does that thing that kids do where they don't know kind of how to deal with it. Like, he's sort of laughing and then, like, ooh, this is actually a bit rough. And, of course, Miguel Ferrer as Albert is just amazing. Just the head shaking and the taking the glasses off Caruso style, you know. Yeah. And it's always nice to see Albert come back as well in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, oh, it's another great moment in law enforcement history. And
I know he's supposed to, but he really did piss me off in this episode. I don't find his laughter at the whole Nadine thing funny. Like, I know you laughed. I don't find it funny.
It's the inappropriateness. It's more of just a surprise, like the way that he's kind of... Anyway, we've not got to that point yet.
We'll argue about that later.
Yeah, we will. I look forward to it. So we see Maddie and Donna meet up in the diner, and she's has requested Laura's glasses. And you see Maddie
Donna
about,
has gone on a fucking mad one
in
this episode. Like, all her... it's Donna.
Well, it's like she... obviously got freaked out in the last episode by the whole James seeing Maddie as Laura.
Yeah.
So she's going through this whole kind of, I have to be like Laura kind of attempt to be a femme fatale kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a very, very odd scenario.
Yeah, and you've got, one of the things that I love about this episode as well is there's lots of weird repetitions in it. Like when... they talk about, Maddie and Donna are talking about the, like Maddie talks about how she hates her glasses and she breaks them and all that kind of stuff. And she mentions that Leland's hair turned white.
Mm.
And they just sort of like look at each other and Donna's like, weird. And then they talk about the Meals on Wheels and again it goes quiet. And then Maddie's like, weird. And there's a couple of moments like that, like later on when Ben and Jerry are talking to Hank. Hank's like, well, you know, Leo was chopping wood. And Jerry's like, indoors? And he's like, well, yeah, you know Leo. And he's like, indoors? And he's like, yeah, you know Leo. And it's just like this kind of odd escalation of repetition that happens a few times in this. And
just going back to Donna and Maddie sitting at the table, I got the impression that, like, when Donna sits down and Maddie gives Donna the sunglasses, Maddie looks like she's disappointed in Donna for putting them on, like she was hoping that Donna wouldn't do whatever it is that she's done to disappoint her.
Yeah, like she's better than that. Like she's going down Laura's path.
Yeah,
kind of
thing. She really looked like she was going to cry a couple of times. And then it would kind of switch a little bit and she'd sort of make the most of the conversation.
And there's always weird scenes whenever you've got Maddie and Donna and James as well sometimes in the diner that it's got this kind of teenage kind of, you know, mystery, young adult novel kind of energy about it as well, where kind of like there's a sort of... contrived immaturity about the way that they relate to each other.
Yeah.
It was a bit later on in the episode when they're at the dinner party round at the Haywoods with all the grown-ups and, you know, they're talking about something and Maddie's like, ace. You know, the way that they talk to each other, particularly in the Lynch episodes, is this very heightened adolescence, kind of like it's a 50s thing. It's a 50s movie kind of thing.
And it's a very, like... It's a juxtaposition with how they're trying to present themselves physically.
Yeah.
To be talking in such adolescent terms, I suppose. Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, they're teenagers played by like 24-year-olds as well, there's that element. Also, there's so much episode. There's so much music in this episode. Sorry, because in a lot of the episodes in season one, when they have dialogue, like heavily expositional scenes, there won't be music.
Mm.
But throughout the whole of this episode, there's like a bed of music.
Yeah.
So we get the Leo locked in a Hungry Horse Montana moment where we learn that, and this is Andy, you know, using his ingenuity, learns that Leo was in Hungry Horse Montana when Teresa Banks was murdered. So and he, of course,
he kind of done it.
Yeah, yes. And we've established that it's the same killer.
Yeah.
So it's basically what they're saying is it's not Leo. They're telling the audience it's not Leo.
Yeah. Although he may have done lots of dodgy things.
Just not this particular
thing. He's not done this particular thing.
We see the one-armed man come into the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Station with lots of ominous music playing. Mm. And I think there is a definite general darkening of the tone, I think, introduced in this episode as well. Yeah, like,
very much so.
We see Harry talk to James. James talks about the mystery man and how it's somebody else. It's not Leo. Mm. And he talks about how...
To fire.
Yeah, about how Laura said to him, do you want to play with fire? Do you want to play with Bob? And he talks about how, you know, Laura said a lot of mad shit. He's like, but this stuck. This was like, this meant something.
Yeah.
And one little kind of weird comedy beat that I barely noticed this the first few times I watched Twin Peaks is just the way that when James explains how he came to be back in possession of the heart, he says that it was in a coconut at Jacoby's. And it's just the way that Cooper leans in and he goes, a coconut? It's just a really weird choice from an acting perspective. When Donna walks into the police station, I love the way that, like, there's like an off-camera wolf whistle, this really weird bit of ADR. And but she looks...
I honestly thought she was going to go, tell me about it.
Yeah, stirred. But the thing is, there's something ridiculous about it that kind of reminds me a little bit of the energy of Hank and his domino. Like, you know when she sucks James's knuckle?
I know.
It's got Hank domino energy going on there. It's like, it's meant to be cool, but you're like, nah... You know, it's like...
He looks like, oh, God, I've got another mad one.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the... Yeah,
knuckle sucker.
And it's like you're trying a bit hard here. But it's kind of like, you know what, Donna? You were a lot sexier when you weren't trying to be sexy.
Yeah.
And also her glasses, like something that Bono would have worn in about 1990.
I thought she was looking a bit Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, I'll be back.
But yeah, so...
It's supremely off-putting.
There's some great Mark Frost writing, though, as well. And it is interesting as well. I noticed that the teleplay was Mark Frost and the story was Mark Frost and David Lynch.
Mm.
So... Basically, what that means to me, says to me, is that the dialogue, all the dialogue is Mark Frost.
Mm.
And all of the broad ideas and, of course, direction is David Lynch.
Mm.
And there is some fun dialogue here about how, you know, James is like kind of calling her out a little bit. And he's like, you know, when did you start smoking? She's like, it releases tension. When you get so tense? When I started smoking. And she basically what we're seeing is that she, you know, she's trying to be Laura.
Yeah, you know, she is.
And
I was hoping that when she leaned back on the bars and did all her, like, oh, God, I just want you, that she'd, like, her hand would slip and she'd fall off or something.
Yeah, it felt a little bit Naked Gun, didn't it? Like, she was going to just go, like, swing back and be like, and just be like,
Brooke Shields in the episode of Friends.
Yes, yes, yes. There was a Brooke Shields in Friends energy.
Yeah.
And there's a great scene of awkwardness between Lucy and Andy when they have to look through the flesh worlds together as their assignment. And I love Cooper's update to Diane when he's walking out. He was like, they were surprisingly cooperative for a company that deals in, well, specializes in human weakness. And, so we see Jacoby in hospital. There's a running gag about the hospital food in this episode, but like just how like almost like poisonously terrible it is. We learn that he followed James and Donna in the pilot episode, and he talks about how he believes that Laura allowed herself to be killed.
Yeah.
He talks about how he can smell scorched engine oil.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, there's something very kind of creepy about that. That feels almost like we've talked before about sort of interstitial spaces, you know, the idea of other worlds piercing through, breaking through, and that feels like that.
Mm.
So Bobby goes to visit Shelley in the hospital, and it's a really sweet scene because although they're still both kind of infantile, you do get the feeling that there is an actual connection.
They are genuinely right for each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, like they do a little, there's a thing they do where they kind of grab each other's head and do like, and it's like, you know, shit that couples do. You know, you've got your little short hand and, you know.
You're going to grab my hair and shake my head around.
No, we have our own equivalents. And
I wonder what they are.
Now's probably not the time to dissect that. They've got their cute things that they do, as do we, it would seem. We see Albert and Cooper and Truman in the hospital, and they connect with Ed. And I love the fact that Ed is still wearing his undercover.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he's taking
his wig off.
You know, I mean, this is the third episode where it's like it's still the same night.
Yeah.
And we move into the next day. But, that would be an interesting look if he hadn't. And basically, he tells us the story about why he's kind of become committed to Nadine, you know, like about how, and we've kind of already been able to piece some of this together.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that she was following him like a bit of a groupie, and he was with Norma, and, you know, he was the kind of captain of the football team. She was like the homecoming queen. Everybody just figured that they would make it together.
Yeah.
And, you know, she sort of had a little dalliance with Hank.
In basically teenage misunderstandings.
Yeah, exactly. So he marries Nadine and then shoots out her eye. And obviously, you know, Cooper has told Albert, like, look, you know, because Cooper can see the way the conversation's going. And he's like, look, Ed needs somebody understanding here. So he sort of pushes Albert to the side. And there's a great little bits of business with Albert of him just judging the coffee and kind of just, you know, doing this whole, like, stuff. And, but it's the look on Albert's face when he's like, and you know what? I shut out her eye. And you can just see him like, did you hear that? You know, did anyone else hear that?
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, he's just like losing his shit and just finding it really funny when Ed's telling. And like, you know, everybody in this scene is playing it exactly as their character should. Like, Ed is just so sincere. And it's heartbreaking. You know, what he's saying legitimately is really sad and informs the character so much.
He's unaware of everything around him. He's just in his grief.
And Cooper's right there for him and trying to be understanding.
He's got no idea that he's finding it, you know, totally bizarre.
Well, they're in their own shows. We've talked about this before, about how you've got these different characters who have these genre identities.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're off in their own sort of places. And I know we were talking about this earlier on, about the fact that I'm amused by this scene, but you were saying, you know, find it funny, insensitivity, all that kind of stuff.
I don't find him funny. And, like, I want to slap the smile off
his
face.
Well, of course you do, because he's a terrible person.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm supposed to.
But the thing that, for me, works about that scene isn't, it's not like I find it funny, ha, 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 laugh out loud. But it's more just the kind of a dichotomy of it, the fact that, one of the things that I love about Twin Peaks is how it can balance these tones. The fact that, you know, that Ed isn't playing it comedically at all.
Mm.
He's playing it completely straight, and it is an effective moment.
Very sincerely,
And Albert is being Albert, but they're such different characters who are kind of like, you know, to use modern terms, they're living their truths, you know, they're doing their thing.
Yep.
And but just the idea of a character in a television show who's like, you know, telling this story and, you know, little moments like when it cuts to Albert and he kind of, you can see him checking his watch. He's like, you know, come on, this is going on a little bit now. And, but it doesn't, for me, neither part of that takes away any from the other. I can't do find Albert funny. I'm lowbrow like that. But it doesn't make what Ed's saying any less effective or heartbreaking or informative.
Yeah.
It's just, that's what the show is.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you will have scenes where, You've got a moment in the first season where there's silly stuff happening and Audrey's crying in the background. You know, it's a balancing act. It's
meant to see Albert with a black eye still, because you feel like...
It's only 3 or 4 days later.
Yeah, but like you feel like that was weeks ago.
Well, particularly as this is like the second season.
Yeah.
So like in real time in the show, there would have been like a whole summer.
Yeah.
Between those two things happening.
Yeah.
And that's part of the sort of the original experience of watching the show as well, was that when Twin Peaks first came on, it kind of took everybody by surprise, and it was only on for like 8 weeks.
Mm.
So if you were somebody who was a Twin Peaks geek like me, you know, the first season drew me in and I became obsessed with the show. And then in the gap between the season, like I scrambled to try and get video cassettes of as many of the episodes as I could from people who'd recorded them. And
yeah.
I bought the books and the soundtrack and all that. So this episode was the first episode that aired when I was like, okay, Twin Peaks, I think I know what you are.
Yeah.
You know, but then it came back and it was this slightly different thing.
Mm.
In the same way that like years, you know, a year after the show had finished, Firewalker came out. And that was a different thing. And then The Return is a different thing, but it's still all Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But it's just had time to kind of breathe and percolate, like a fish in the percolator. Indeed. And another little bit of Albert that I love, that's a really subtle moment, is when Cooper, Truman, and Albert are walking down the corridor of the hotel after this scene. And Cooper says something like, oh, you know, it's a real shame that blah, blah happened. And Truman's like, yeah. And you just hear Albert go, yeah. In the background as well, just mimicking. We go into the diner. We see Bobby come in, and his dad calls him over to have a conversation with him.
My honey, Major Briggs.
Yes. This is, I just think, a friggin' amazing scene.
Mm.
It's just this really artful kind of spiritual moment that doesn't advance the story at all.
No.
Really.
But it's a beautiful moment and kind of a chance for father and son to actually connect on an emotional level.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they've been at loggerheads the whole time, unable to see each other.
Yeah.
You know, and the way he tells the story is beautiful.
And it's a slow dawning because, you know, he starts talking about how, and it's this real transactional conversation. How was school? School's fine. How was work? Work's fine. You know, he's like,
What do you do? It's classified.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see these barriers. And they just kind of from out of nowhere, like Major Briggs says, like, I want to tell you about a vision. And he's like, and it's not a dream. You know, a dream is just, you know, cataloguing of the day's events, you know, but a subconscious. And he tells him about how, you know, he lays it all out and about how his son comes to him and he was filled with this sense of optimism for his future. And it's the way that, I mean, obviously, Don Davis is great. He's a great orator. You know, he's just a great kind of storyteller. He's got an amazing voice.
He's got great pacing to what he's saying.
And the writing is incredible as well. Oh, of course it is,
yeah.
And that's Mark Frost. It's real Mark Frost at his best. Mm. But I think the real secret weapon of this scene is Dana Ashbrook, because it's a slow dawning, because he's listening and at first he's confused. And then he's like, bored. Oh, shit, he's actually really talking to me for like the first time ever.
Yeah.
You know.
And he looks a bit bored by the story to start with, like, oh, God, here he goes again. Yeah. But then realises that there's actually something pretty significant for him to say. And you know, to be told that he's going to be okay and, like, his father has this vision of him healthy and happy and successful. And
spoiler alert, we see how that plays out in the third season of Twin Peaks. His life goes in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about that scene in season three about how that affected him, you know.
Yeah.
But
it's just lovely. It's a lovely start to finish, those two.
One of my favourite moments in that scene as well is it's a really little moment. He finishes it and it's the way he says to him, it was you. You were my vision. And it's just this... It's the way that he kind of caps it. It's such a beautiful scene and really effective. And it's just one of those sequences that every time I see it, I get something different from it, like because of where I am in my own life with whether I've got children or where I am in.
I love that they don't hug at the end. They stay very much within
the
parameters of their characters. you know, it makes it more of a believable thing. Like, you know, his father is a military man. He's not going to hug him.
Well, you get the impression that if they went home that night and had dinner, neither of them would mention it.
No.
You know, and it's the way he says, he shakes his hands and he says, "I wish you the best in all things, son."
Yeah.
You know, and there's and still a like, formality. And it's
like, oh, I'm so pleased I had this chance to tell you this, you know, story. It's like, well, you could tell him any time. Yeah. You could seek him out and tell him, but yeah, that's not the way he works.
But the other thing as well is that it shows that a character who you think of as being this guy who is all about bureaucracy and rules can have a spiritual side.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's a really beautiful thing, the fact that it's kind of not, it's like an anti-pigeonholing thing a lot. And then, of course, the scene ends with Bobby having his memory jogged that it was Hank that shot Leo.
Yeah.
And obviously helping the audience there as well. We see Cooper lay it out. This is another one of those great audience members who may, you know, not remember what happened, but also, you know, having a bit fun.
It is good to get everything up to a point, you know.
But there is new information. Where we are. You know, the idea that they actually have a pretty clear idea about what's going on, apart from the identity of the third man.
I know. I do feel quite sorry for Audrey at this point, because it is like she's on a fruitless mission, because they know all that shit that she's trying to find out. Mm.
It's not even helpful information.
No, they're sort of far past it.
Yeah.
They don't need to know if Laura and Ronette were up at One Eye Jack's. Like, they're way past that.
Yeah, yeah. But we get some summary and clarification. Mm. Andy cries looking at the picture of Laura, and Albert mentions it's a three hanky crime, and Andy stands up to him, tells him to shut his mouth, and Lucy looks all sort of aroused.
Fizzy knickers.
I love the way that Cooper's like, Jacques Renault is dead, blah, blah is dead, Waldo the Minor Bird is dead. You know, the fact that he gives him equal standing with the rest of them as well.
Yeah.
We see Truman take Pete home as well. They get a note from Joseph from Seattle and they haven't found Catherine. I think Pete's a really underrated character in Twin Peaks. His scenes are all really lovely.
Yeah.
We see Hank go and see the brothers. I love the way that the Horn brothers are circling
him
throughout the whole, like just these couple of little cartoon vultures.
Well, they're like the... what are the animals in The Lion King?
Well, the hyenas. The
hyenas.
They're
like hyenas.
And again, you see a darkness in them as well. Like, Jerry is much more aggressive and self-assured.
Mm.
And, you know, Ben as well. Like, they talk about how Hank's like, oh, they won't even find Catherine's teeth. And Ben's like, oh, what pretty teeth they were. There's a kind of macabre about him.
It's like, he doesn't give a shit that she's dead.
Well, it's like when Neville Lynch comes back, he always reminds you that the dark characters are. He's like, no, these are bad people.
Yeah.
You know, because you watch them every week and they have
you start getting a bit of sympathy for them. Yeah,
he's like, no.
No, these are terrible people.
We see Donna take over the Meals on Wheels. We see the Haywood Supper Club.
I did laugh when Donna calls Norma. Hi, it's Donna. Like,
sexy new Donna.
You fully expect Norma to be like, eh? Who?
Yeah. You don't sound like Donna. I love the sequence in the dinner round at the Haywoods. The way that throughout the whole scene, the camera's just floating and everything's fine, but you just know.
And that random third daughter that's come out of nowhere. Oh,
Gersten, yeah. She's in season three. I mean, it's funny because you've seen the...
Yeah, but like in season one, you think that Donna has one younger sister.
Well, you only see her in the pilot.
Yeah.
You don't really see that much of the Haywood household during the first season. And I think that Alicia Witt, who plays the other daughter,
yeah,
I think it's just that David Lynch likes working with her. I mean, she was in Dune as a child. She was a child actor in that. And she was in Hotel Room, this thing that Lynch did for HBO as well.
I've seen her in lots of things.
Yeah, I think he was just... Well, also, she becomes the... Oh, it's a spoiler. She's in the X-Files as well, but I'm not going to say in what capacity because that's a huge spoiler. We see the poetry recital, and it's one of those things where, because of course Laura and Donna, their parents are, they're the kind of hoi polloi, you know. I mean, Leland's a lawyer, Doc Hayward's, well, he's a doctor. So they, you know, have these, they're cultured families, yeah. You know, and they have nights where, you know, and you see Donna's sister talking about how they've all been like the top of their maths classes, and she's a pianist, and her sister reads poetry, and she plays Mendelssohn and all this kind of stuff. And there's this really uneasy scene when she's reading a poem about Laura, which was obviously written by David Lynch.
Mm.
And like I say, the camera's floating around the room and everything's lovely. And you can see Sarah's right on the edge, as she always is, and Lena's sort of holding her hand and smiling and, you know, playing the strong, you know, father kind of character. And then they have a like a sort of, they talk about Leland's hair, and he talks about it, and then he starts singing Get Happy. And it's great. And at first, the scene's really nice because you can see like Maddie and Donna being kind of embarrassed in the way that they teenagers get when parents have had a few drinks and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. But then it just starts to get, the wheels start to come off a little bit.
Dark, yeah.
And he starts singing faster and faster, and he passes out, and, you know, you see that maybe Leland has still got he's still got a way to go. But he talks about how he's turned a corner, and we'll see that.
Mm-hmm.
Cooper heads to bed. He talks about how he nearly, premature purchase of the proverbial farm. He references the Korean experiments to sleep deprivation, the Korean war experiments on GIs. And he says about how he thought that he saw a giant. We see Audrey praying to him as well. Great bit of geeky reference to the feedback about music earlier, but we hear Questions in a World of Blue, which is a great Angelo Badalamonte piece that's introduced here, playing in the background. We see the giants appear, and I love the way that when Cooper sits up, he just really confidently says, I am not dreaming.
Mm.
And again, telling the audience that, you know, this is happening.
Yeah.
One subtle moment that I think I've noticed before, but it's the way that when the giant disappears,
is a ball of light that goes into Cooper,
doesn't it? Yeah. And he says earlier on as well, like, sorry, I brushed past this a little bit, is when Cooper says to him, where do you come from? And he says something like, no, the question is, where have you gone?
Mm.
You know, almost implying that, like, Cooper comes from the same place.
Yeah.
But Cooper has left and gone into the world.
Yeah.
You know, Cooper's the alien.
Yeah.
In, you know, quotes, the real world.
Mm.
We go into the hospital. We move down the corridors. We see Ronette have a vision of the long-haired man. It gave
me two legit jump scares.
It is a really horrifying sequence. Mm. I think the thing that's scarier about that scene is Laura. I think Laura's scarier than Bob. You know, the way that she's
got that manic look on her face.
Look, her eyes are white. And she's
got blood all around her mouth.
Yeah. It's really ugly. And then over the end credits, you've got the Hayward daughter playing, you know, some boogie-woogie kind of Jules Holland sounding thing on the piano. Any final thoughts before we wrap up, Anna?
Just such a solid opening to the second season, and pushing the show in such a powerful direction. Mm. You know, it's not stagnating. It's really pushing you into these new and interesting scenarios and making you really question everything, which is, it's such a smart show.
Yeah, it's really challenging and reinventing itself and not stagnating. But, that's a great way of putting it.
But it's infinitely watchable, you know. It's not homework.
Yeah, it's not hard work.
It doesn't feel difficult to keep up. Like, there is a lot to take in. And like you say, you know, you take different things on every time you watch it. You know, and that's the beauty of it. There's always something to see, something to take from a rewatch of it. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it can be really horrifying, but then really funny, and then really moving, you know, and this episode has got it. I mean, it runs the whole gamut. You know, I mean, that 90 minutes that we watch tonight, you know, it runs the whole gamut of the human experience.
Mm.
And, you know, people think about, I think a lot of people think of this episode as the point where Twin Peaks went weird. You know, I mean, it was always odd. It was always quirky. But this is the point when it went weird. And I think that this was too weird for a lot of people. Mm. But I think that this was the point where people who were really into the show were like, oh, yes, okay, we're really getting to it now, you know.
Now stretching your legs.
You know, yeah. It's like when, you know, musical analogies, like when you like a band that are really popular and there's some element of their music that you really like and then they hone in on that and you're like, oh, yeah, that's the shit. But that alienates a large part of the audience because it doesn't have the broad appeal that
But, I mean,
before,
I suppose...
You know?
That's what comes with being confident in what you do.
Yeah,
you
and know, I mean, and they could have really easily just carried on doing cherry pie and coffee and you know, all that kind of stuff.
But it would have had such a short sell by date.
And it's funny as well, watching it now, I remember how shocking it was when season two started and it went in this direction. And it's easy to forget that now because we think of the original Twin Peaks as this whole thing. And when Twin Peaks The Return happened, and initially that was jarring, but then you settled back into it. It was kind of that again.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, no, we're not going to give you what you want. We're going to give you what you need.
Mm.
And eventually you realize, okay, that's absolutely right. But yeah. Okay, well, we will be back very soon to talk about the second episode of Twin Peaks, Season 2. Please tell us about that, Hannah.
The episode is called Coma. Synopsis says, Albert determines that neither Leo nor Jax killed Laura, but he is unable to find any leads into who shot Cooper. Cooper says they must find the third man, who he believes to be Bob, the grey-haired man.
Ooh.
It is directed by David Lynch and written by Harley Payton.
Why, so the next episode is directed by David Lynch as well.
Mm-hmm.
Good on him. Okay, a quick reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com or on our YouTube channel. We are also on Instagram and Twitter at rewatchproj. Check out our friend shows. And we also appreciate reviews over at Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. But for now, we will remind you that the owls are not what they seem, and we will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.